Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's music row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Lowell Tolhurst is the drummer and co-founder of The Cure. He first met lead singer Robert Smith when they were just 5 years old. Together with their other Catholic school friend, Michael Dempsey, they went on to make dark, brooding music that reflected the isolation they felt as the only punks living in their small English town. As The Cure's sound developed in the 80s, they released a string of three albums that Lowell now defines as the band's quote-unquote goth period. Today we'll hear Lowell talk in detail about the making of those records. He'll also discuss the book he just released last month called Goth: A History, which explores the architects of the post-punk genre, bands like Susie and the Banshees, Joy Division, and Bauhaus. In addition to the book, Lowell is also releasing a new album with his old friend Budgie, the drummer from the Banshees. The album's called Los Angeles, and it features an all-star list of guests, including U2's The Edge and LCD Sound System's James Murphy. On today's episode, Leah Rose talks to Lowell Tolhurst about growing up an outcast in post-World War II England and how he and Robert Smith first bonded over a Hendrix record. Lowell also gives a window into the creation of The Cure's three goth albums. That's 17 Seconds, Faith, and Pornography.
This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond.
Here's Leah Rose's interview with Lowell Tolhurst.
Let's start talking a little bit about the book. So you've written two books.
Yeah.
The first is a memoir called Cured, The Tale of Two Imaginary Boys. The newest book, Goth, A History. And I found the writing, I've been listening to the audiobook of Cured.
Okay.
Which you read, and it's just excellent. And it's been my walking partner now. I go on long walks and listen, and the writing is so simple and straightforward and feels very uncluttered, and there's not a lot of ornamentation. And it struck me that it's sort of similar to your style as a drummer.
Yeah. Well, yes. Thank you. You're the first person that's noticed that, and and that's why. You're right. It's like I'd like to be, I wouldn't say minimalistic, but I don't have a desire to make things heavily, you know, ornamented, I suppose is the word. You know, and that's true in writing. I mean, you know, if I think of the writers that I really admire, they pay great attention to the sentence, and that's how I do. I don't, you know, it's funny. I love notebooks. You know, I obsessively collect notebooks because I think they're beautiful, and I write stuff in it. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, I look at it and I can't. What am I right? Well, what am I? I can't read my own writing. So So I type everything straight away. But what I do is, as I type it out, and I do it like music. I just let it flow, get the idea out, and then maybe 2 weeks later, I come back and I have a look at it and go, "Oh, okay, take that out, put this in," and I edit it. In drumming, you know, I loved Jackie Leibitz from Can because he would say you have to play monotonous.
Yeah.
And I understand that because it's like the mantra, and that's what I wanted to get. That's what I wanted to do with the drums. I wanted to make you feel that you're part of the whole thing, and that required it to be precise and minimalistic. Same thing with writing. So writers that I really liked were, like, for this current book, Goth, it was hard for me to find my initial voice because I'm writing about other people. I'm not just writing about my own experiences. I mean, there's a lot of my own stuff in there, but I'm writing about other people. I wanted to project the other people's stories in a way that wasn't just purely journalistic. I didn't want to do that because I can't, because I'm not a journalist. And the way I personalized it was I'd been reading a lot of California writer Joan Didion from the 60s and 70s. And I love the way that all of her sentences are crafted very precisely, you know? So I thought, okay, there's my template, you know, so that's
very cool.
Where I went. But I'm glad that you actually, you're the first person I know that said that to me. So that's good.
Thank you. I've really been enjoying it. And I highly recommend the audiobook. A lot of times with audiobooks, you get sort of like a narrator who has no connection to the story, and they can put on voices when they're reading dialogue, and it can be very distracting. So I really enjoyed hearing your voice because obviously it's your story.
Yeah, it's funny because at the beginning when I did Cured, and I actually recorded both Cured and the current book, Goth, in the same studio because I loved the place that I recorded it in. And also it's very near my house. But I remember that the recording engineer at the end of one day said to me, you know, normally I'm not really involved with what's going on, you know, just like listening for, you know, pops and clicks and stuff. He said, is there light at the end of the tunnel with this? I said, yes, don't worry. that's coming in the next couple of days. You'll hear that, you know. But
okay.
Yeah, it was funny.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, so I wanted to start off by talking about the Cure's goth period as you outline it in the book, Goth, A History.
Right.
So the Cure's goth period, as you lay it out, consists of three consecutive albums.
Yeah.
The first is 17 Seconds, released in 1980, Faith, released in 1981, and Pornography in 1982.
Yeah.
And these are all albums that you said you were deeply involved with making.
Right.
So let's start with 17 Seconds. It's the Cure's second album. Do you remember any of the conversations within the band that led up to developing the sound for that album, because it was quite different than the sound from the first album?
Well, I don't want to make up a story because I don't think, you know, it's like when you write conversations in a book, a lot of the time, you know, I challenge anybody in the world to remember conversations verbatim, even from like yesterday. You can't, it's impossible. Yeah. You know, most of the time I would know, okay, I know how these people speak about things. I know what we talked about roughly. So I'm going to construct a conversation from that, which will be in their voice and will be correct. I think with 17 Seconds, we had our first album was really a live set that we had played for, you know, a couple of years. And so that seemed the most obvious thing. We go and record that. We can do it quickly. We know what we're playing. And that's how it happened. But for the second album, we finally realized that we had, you know, we weren't just going to record one album and that was it. We had a chance to do another record. You know, most people will tell you in bands that they sort of put everything into the first album and then suddenly think, what are we going to do next? Because we, you know, and usually it's like, you know, you have your whole life to make your first album, like they say, and 6 months to do your second album. And we were kind of not really in that position, but we thought, okay, we better do what we really want to get out now, what we were feeling at that time, because, you know, maybe number two is it, and that's all we'll have the chance to do. You know, we felt lucky with the first one and people liked it enough to say, well, let's start thinking about the second one. And that was really a a great idea that Robert had, because he said to, you know, a manager, Chris Parry, would come in the studio for the first album. And for the first album, you know, we were fairly young. We didn't really know what we were doing. We would look at things and, you know, sort of let them get on with it, him and Mike Hedges, the engineer. Mm-hmm. So for the second album, we said, well, you know what? We've seen enough of what goes on and how to do it. We'd like to do it ourselves. And Robert was very insistent about that. We'd like to do it ourselves. And, you know, it's a credit to Parry that he went, yeah, okay, that's fine. You know, his offices were in the same complex as the studio. So, you know, once a week he would come down and just have a little listen, you know. So he left us to our own devices. And as I say in Goth, you know, to me, it was a very creative time because we were allowed to do it ourselves. You know, yeah. We were given the keys to the kingdom and like we can go in and do it. So that leaves you to be a lot more experimental. In fact, I was telling somebody the other week that a lot of bands, when they start making, you know, their second, third, fourth albums, they get this idea in their head that they all have separate roles, and they have, you know, I do this, you do that, and, you know, that's how we make it work. Because
sort of like the roles in a household or in a marriage or partnership.
It's any kind of partnership, because, you know, and not unreasonably, the theory goes, well, if it worked once, this is our formula. This is how we do it. And I think that's kind of misguided for two reasons. Because one, modern music is really the only sort of art form where people are required to reproduce what they did before in the same way, but slightly different. You know, it's like a painter. You wouldn't say to a painter, well, paint me that portrait again, but from this different angle. That's what I want to see. You know, you let them do whatever they want to do. So for 17 seconds, there was one session where we said, hey, let's just swap instruments. So, you know, I played guitar and Robert played drums. And we recorded a couple of things. Most of them were terrible. So we decided that we go back to what we all do. But we kept some little snippets of it, and they're actually on the album in a way. You know, you don't really know where they are, but they're there. So that's also freeing in your mind. Yeah. You don't have this thought process that, oh, you know, I have to just do this. You can put input into different areas. And that's, you know, if you trust each other, that's a good way to do it, because then you've not just got, you know, one mind on one thing, you've got everybody's mind on everything, and that works, you know. So,
and in Goth, you wrote that over the years there have been a lot of assumptions that have been made about The Cure's creative process.
Yeah.
And I took that to mean that people just assume that a lot of the songwriting came from Robert.
Yeah.
But now you're saying that, inspired in part by your sobriety, that wasn't always the case.
No, I mean, you know, as things got further on in The Cure, you know, and to the point where I wasn't well enough to contribute like I used to, you know, at the beginning, especially for those first, you know, the second, third and fourth album, they were much more democratic in their approach. And it's funny, I was talking to Pearl Thompson a little while back, and I said, oh, it tells you how far it was back, because I just finished Cured. And I said, he said, well, you know, I've always known you were a writer. You were a writer when we were 15 or 16. And so I thought about it, and I thought, well, yeah, you know, a lot of the times, you know, Robert's got to sing the words, right? So, you know, he has the final say on what he's going to sing, because you can't sing stuff that you don't believe. But there was a lot more collaboration and just, you know, general molding of things back then. And that, you know, I would put some words in, Simon put some words in now and again. Mm-hmm. It's really guarantees to make things stronger. Now, as things progress, people start, you know, it also happens, you know, for people that manage bands and stuff, it's a lot easier if you don't have to deal with everybody in the band, you just have to deal with one person. So,
yeah.
You know, things become that way. And, you know, all credit to Robert, he's a great songwriter and he's got, you know, a lot of good ideas. Personally, I think for The Cure, the best version of the three-piece band was for those albums. I mean, the first one was a four-piece, but it's like the most pure and condensed of that band. And that was much more collaborative, you know? So, you know, that's the thing. It's like, I don't want to turn around and go, oh, no, he never wrote anything, because that's not true. He's obviously the songwriter. But That doesn't mean that anybody else didn't do it. I mean, and it went on. We tried different formats of that. You know, when we did Kiss Me, we had so many songs because we'd all, by this time, we didn't do stuff together. We did it separately, you know, so we all have little studios at home and go, okay, 6 months, and then we'll come back together and we'll see what we've got. And that's the reason that, you know, Kiss Me was like a double album. I mean, it could have been a triple album. We had 100 bits of songs to start with, and then we whittled that down to like 35, and then finally to what, 17 or 19, something like that, you know. So everybody had some creativity, you know, and that was what was pretty good about The Cure, because when you put that all together, it's unstoppable, you know?
Yeah. I was curious about the song Play for Today.
Yeah.
So that's the second song on 17 Seconds, and it's a pretty substantial mood shift from the intro. Do you remember how that song came together? And
I seem to remember that we had a sort of rough version of that when Michael Dempsey was around. But anyway, but I know that for the lyric, it was the first time that I'd felt like I could write a lyric that was accessible to my feelings, you know, because the previous things like Three Imaginary Boys and Fire in Cairo and Another Day, they were far more impressionistic, you know, in the way that I presented things. So that's it. That's why there's a difference, because it's much more to the point and less flowery, I suppose, is the word. Yeah.
And that's a breakthrough, I imagine, as a writer.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think that at however old I was then, 20, that I even thought about that. I didn't. I just sort of instinctively felt, oh, well, this is a better kind of thing. This is more what I want to say. It's just the only way I knew how to deal with it, you know, write it down. So, and Robert liked it. And so off it went, you know.
So is that like you wrote the entire lyrics, gave it to him, and then he interpreted it as a singer and sort of changed?
I think I gave him sort of like the basis for it all. Mm-hmm. And he probably chopped and changed a few things around, because, you know, people forget, you know, like songs are not, it's not poetry you're writing, and it's not prose. It's this weird hybrid in between lyrics. And lyrics, a lot of the time, work better if they're onomatopoeic, and lyrics work better sometimes if they're not quite grammatically correct, or you know, certain words you just can't sing, or you could try, but, you know. So that decision was always left, you know, obviously, to the singer. So that's how that worked, really.
I imagine you must find it interesting to see what songs resonate with a really wide audience after you release the album. And do you have any theories why A Forest caught on the way it did?
Yeah, it's like audiences don't, by and large, I mean, obviously there are exceptions to the rule. Audiences are not looking at you thinking, or listening to you thinking, oh, that was good the way they played that, or that was good the way that's put together. It's much more visceral than that. You know, it's like drums, right? Most people, other than drummers, don't really notice what's going on with the drummer. But if something's wrong, if something goes bad, they might not even know what it is, but they think, oh, no, something's not right. It's something's off. It doesn't feel right. And they don't know what it is. So the point where it works for an audience is when they understand completely that it's you and your expression, right? That it's not to do with how well you play or how bad you play. No, it's a terribly overused word lately, but it's authenticity, you know, and that's what they feel.
Do you remember why you decided to bring the drums in when you did in A Forest?
You know, we had liked a lot of like the early sort of krautrock bands, you know, Can and Neu. And like what I always liked about them was things feel like they're going forward with that motoric beat, but they also seem to stay in the same place as well. You know, it's like it's static, but it's moving, you know, and that to us seemed like the thing that we really wanted to express with the drums. So You know, Mike Hedges was instrumental in getting that sound. You know, he used a lot of different techniques which we'd never seen before. And I don't think a lot of people used them at the time even. So, and he was young like us as well, you know, so we had open minds about what you do. You know, he wasn't stuck with like, oh no, this is how you record drums. You can't do anything else. We were open to doing it a different way. I think also, like somebody said to me the other night, it's, you know, the lyric. I thought the title, Robert did the lyric, but the actual lyric, if you think about it, is a sort of encapsulation of everything goth and romantic. If you think about it, it's like there's this sense of mystery, there's this sense of, you know, loss at the same time, and it's all there in one very succinct lyric. So I think that's what people respond to, you know.
Yeah. You described your drumming style on the album as you play monotonous half man, half machine.
Yeah. That's Jackie Leibich from Cannes. That's his quote. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I thought that it was a drum machine listening to.
A lot of people did.
Yeah. That seems sort of like it would be hard to keep up, especially playing live.
Yes, very hard. But, you know, the thing is, it's like practice. People think, sometimes they watch drummers who are very flamboyant, and they think, oh, that must be very hard. And sometimes it is. But most of the time, that's a bit like a sort of a sideshow trick, you know? It's like, I once saw this thing with Ginger Baker, and he said, you know, people think I'm playing things really fast, but what I'm doing is I'm playing lots of quite simple things, but on different limbs, slightly shifted from each other. And so it gives the impression of going really fast. And I, you know, I know that's very difficult to do because you've got to think about everything all at the same time.
Yeah.
But in terms of physicality, you know, it sounds faster than your body is actually kind of doing. It's hard to explain, but it kind of, it sounds like that. In drumming, I always tell people, if you're doing it right, you could play for hours and you'll just feel elevated. You know, you can walk off stage, have to wait 3 or 4 hours and you'll feel fine. If you're doing it wrong, it's like running the worst marathon of your life. And you know, at the end, you're like, you can't sit up. It's really like dancing. You know, you just have to remember, okay, well, that wasn't right, but it has to move to here now. And that has to move to there. And as long as you can get in that, you'll be fine, you know, but that's the trick. The trick is to learn how to do that. It's like, you know, I watch guitarists a lot and I think to myself, how do they know just instinctively where their fingers are going? They're not looking. And but it's just that, you know, you have to, it's like Malcolm Gladwell in his book Outliers, he said, you know, some people think it's a bit dismissive, but I don't think it is. He said, like, you know, the difference between being good and being great is like 10,000 hours of practice. Yeah. He's got a point, you know, because if I think about it, at the beginning when we started The Cure, we spent the first 3 years at Robert's house just playing like 3 times a week. It was more of a social thing. We'd just meet there, you know, play, go down the pub, come back, play a bit more. But that's where we got our 10,000 hours in, you know. So
before we move on from 17 Seconds, is there any other stories you want to share? Anything from that period overall that's important to know?
I don't know. I think more than anything, like I say in goth, it was for me, and I think it, you know, I think I can say it for everybody else. It was the discovery of our own ethos, really. You know, it was the discovery of who we really were. And that we could be who we really were and do something with it, you know, whereas before we felt a bit more constrained. That's really why when I think about it, when Robert, you know, is a bit dismissive of the first album, it's because, you know, it wasn't wholly our involvement. It was like, yes, it was us, but it was us put through this filter of, you know, a different thing, mainly through the manager. So, and he had just signed like the Jam, you know, to Polygram. So he was like, that was in his mind. I'm going to do another version of this 3-piece band and it's going to be a pop band. And, it's kind of different. But, you know, I think the other good thing is it was a time where there was, you know, I don't discount the fact of being in the right place at the right time either. Mm-hmm. You know, there was much more of an openness to letting things evolve rather than like, okay, we're going to do that this year and then it doesn't work, then we have to try something completely different. And, you know, there was more time to do things, I feel.
We have to pause for a quick break and then we'll come back with more from Leah Rose and Lowell Tolhurst.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
We're back with more from Leah Rose and Lowell Tolhurst.
Speaking of evolution, when you were going into Faith, the next album.
Yeah.
What was the thought on how the sound would build or change?
I think for Faith, we wanted it to be, you know, at first it just, we wanted it to sound a bit more, like it ended up sounding a bit more, not dramatic, but a bit more glacial, I suppose, really. Mm-hmm. And it didn't really do that at first. You know, we had some sessions and it was like, not feeling, you know, we've been on the road a lot. And that was the problem for a lot of bands. You know, like, you have a successful album and then you have a successful second album, then you're on the road forever and ever, and then you're committed to do another album. You're like, okay, well, we better do another album now. Well, how are we going to, you know, where are we going to find the time to do it? I don't know. People say, oh, they write on the road. I never found the time to write on the road. You know,
but you're probably exhausted.
Well, you know, road time is a whole different world, right? You know, like, people would say to me, oh, I'll call you next Wednesday, and I'd say, yeah, I'm going to be on the road then, so it may happen or it may not. You can't really organize that kind of thing. So if, you know, for Faith started off being a bit rushed, and then some things happened. You know, my mother got very sick, and it was obvious she was going to pass away. Robert's grandmother as well. And so that focused our mind a bit more on what ended up to be the main sort of topic about it. You know, and you have to think that me and Robert, and Michael Dempsey, but, you know, by that time he wasn't there. Me and Robert grew up Catholic, you know, and, which is kind of a different proposition in England, because you have to remember that Henry VIII dissolved all the churches because, you know, the Pope wouldn't let him get divorced for his sixth wife or whatever. So he decided, well, I'll come out, I'll just form my own church, you know, which sounds kind of familiar about things that are happening, you know, in the world now. But anyway, that's what he did. So consequently, all the Catholic churches in England was sort of taken over at that point, and it was sidelined, really, Catholicism in England. So one of the reasons that the cure even started was, you know, I met Robert at school, but I didn't go to school in the town I grew up in, because I had to go to the next town because there wasn't a Catholic school in the town I grew up in. So, you know, I kind of knew Robert because he used to live next door to my grandmother at first, but then him and his dad and his family moved like one town on. So went to the same school, and that's how, you know, we started everything. But, you know, I think, like I say in Goth, not only did I feel an outsider because of the things I was thinking about and the way, you know, I think most teens feel a little outside of stuff. It was exacerbated by the fact that I was already an outsider to most English people, you know, because I didn't go to Church of England in the town, you know. So in summer vacation from school, you know, when I was 14, I didn't know any of the kids in my town because I didn't go to school with them. And I wasn't old enough to drive, and I wasn't old enough to really take, you know, public transport myself and get around and stuff. And it was too far to ride on my bicycle. So I'm stuck in my town for the whole summer with nobody. The library was my friend, because in England back then you got one ticket for the library and you could take three things out on that ticket. Well, I had somehow I finagled three tickets, so I could pick up nine items every week, you know, and I would get like a whole bunch of books, and they also did records, you know. They did records, so I got records and I listened to every, I didn't care what record it was, I just take the next three records, the next three records, and I just listened to everything that summer while reading. So summer vacation in English schools at the time was nearly 3 months. You know, it was like, you know, that's really what started me on the whole road to everything, because I had this intensive, you know, self-imposed course because I had nothing else to do, you know.
I remember you talking about in Cured that early on you and Robert bonded over a Jimi Hendrix record that you had both heard. Yeah. So was he the first person that you were really able to talk about music to?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you know, the good thing, like middle school, which I think in England was like from 11 to 13, right? So it was a little experimental. Instead of keeping like, you know, go to one class and then the bell rings and you go to the next class, they had this thing, okay, where, you know, certain guys, certain pupils, if you were at the top end of the class or whatever, you could go and do your own project in the library, which would be, you know, sort of compilation of history, geography, English, and of course religion, because it's a Catholic school. So you know, draw all those things together. We did a project. So me and Robert were in that, and a few other people. I think Michael Dempsey was in it as well. And, you know, we'd sit in the library and we'd do our work, but we'd also talk about stuff. And he was the first person I knew, other than myself, that had heard that record. So I'm like, oh, you like Hendrix, right? So yeah, so we sort of bonded over that, you know. And then I was like, again, you know, going backwards and forwards, swapping records backwards and forwards, and just ideas from that. So that's really how most bands start. I mean, I talked to a friend of mine, James Murphy from LCD Sound System, and he said to me, when you start playing music, you try to make songs like the people you like, you know, like you like them, you try to make a song like that. And the way you get it wrong, because you always get it wrong, because you don't have the same technique or the same influences or even the same understanding of how to play it, the way you get it wrong is what becomes your sound, you know. That's kind of how The Cure started. We would do songs that were like, in the beginning, we would do these like triptych songs, which were like 10 minutes long, three different sort of, you know, intervals of stuff. And they were like really bad versions of stuff that we listened to. There was some like psychedelic stuff in there. And then as bands like the Buzzcocks came along, there was some stuff that was a bit simpler and things, but there was all kinds of things that we sort of threw in, and that's really what influenced us. And we would write these songs. And then I think the change came when we thought about doing something like Boys Don't Cry. We're like, well, we can't do these 10-minute epics anymore. We're going to do like, try and write a 3-minute pop song, you know, and that's where it all came from. But obviously the basis of that is informed from the earlier stuff. And I think some of that stuff made it onto, like I think we did a compilation, Join the Dots or something. I think some of that's on there, like in rough form, you know, and they're quite embarrassing, really, listening to them now. Yeah, there's sort of like, I think Winter, I think that's on there. We did a whole Seasons section as well, you know. But so here's an interesting story. At one point, you know, it's a small town on the outskirts of the big city.
Crawley.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like being in Los Angeles and living in the valley. There was only one other band in town, which was fronted by Neil Gaiman, the writer, right? And I remember, you know, he would have costume changes, like playing in the pub, but he would have costume changes and things, which was very, you know, exotic for the time. Yeah. But I read something recently where he said, you know, I decided to become a writer instead because, you know, the only other band in our town was The Cure, you know, so we just stopped, you know. But he obviously went on to do something really, really good, you know, but wonderful, you know, and he found his own creative force. But the whole thing about it was that you know, you take that stuff and it becomes your own,
right?
Your own sound, you know. And then you know, for us especially, because we weren't in London, we were able to sort of, you know, mature on our own without too many outside things coming in, you know.
Yeah. I was watching when The Cure was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and Trent Reznor said that your style is instantly recognizable and it's very sonically distinct. And I just wonder, like you're saying, that you try other things and then you settle on a sound and it just sort of comes to be. But it's really incredible if you think about it.
Yeah, I have two ideas about that. You know, when we were asked to do the Hall of Fame, at first, you know, Robert wasn't too keen about it. He was like, well, what is it? You know, how does it work? Is it some kind of, you know, it doesn't seem like it would be appropriate. And I said, no, you're wrong. I said, because I've lived here, by that time I'd lived here a quarter of a century. And I said, you know, all the, you know, the goth kids that lived in a little town in the middle of nowhere, I said, they would love it for us to be on there. I said, because it would be vindication for them. You know, they would go, okay, look, see, I was right about them. They, you know, did something good. And eventually I sort of won him over and we did it and it worked. But the best thing for me was, you know, they said, well, who would you like to induct you? And we were thinking about, why don't we ask Trent? Because, you know, he comes from that line and the way, and you understand it. And so he said, yeah. And when he got up there, he said, the first thing he said was, you know, I grew up in small town USA, you know, Mercer, Pennsylvania, looking out over cornfields, you know, and this music coming through college radio was the way I escaped, you know. And I looked at Robert, I was like, yeah, see, look, that's exactly what I'm talking about, you know. And so that's why when I got up on stage, I gave him a big hug, you know, because it's like, that's the truth. You know, even today, you know, I spent 40 years going around America. I can walk into any small town in the States and I can spot the 5 or 6 kids who are going to be goth straight away. You know, like if I walk into the cafe or something, I go, yeah, them.
What do you see? What do you see and what do you sense?
It's a way of being, and, you know, they're usually reading a book or something. So, you know, they're not looking at their phones all the time. You know, I can see them. They don't have to, you know, they don't have to look goth. And that's why I was pains to explain that in the book. Goth's not just, you know, the way you look and the way your hair is and stuff. Right. And it always amuses me as well if I'm passing through those places or something and I do see some real goths, you know, that look, have got, like now they've got the whole, you know, kit and caboodle, as they say. They put everything and they've got the uniform. And if I walk past them and they don't recognize me, that always gives me a little chuckle, you know, because myself, you don't know, but you know, here's where it came from. And
right.
And so, you know, which is a nice thing for me. But the thing for The Cure's sound, like a few years ago, I was looking at, like, when Google Earth came out and you could go and, you know, walk around every street. So I'm sure I did what a lot of people did. I went and walked around where I grew up, you know. Yeah. And that amazed me as well. Yeah, I called Rob up and said, or wrote to him or something, and I said, you know, it is no surprise to me at all now, on, you know, 40 years later, looking at this stuff, the reason we sounded the way we did, because it's all there in the dark, dank countryside, in the streets of the town we grew up in. It's there.
Yeah, you described the slate gray skies. And I was going to ask you, what environmental factors, how does that seep into the music, or what influence does that have on a sound, on a band sound?
I think that always makes things very soft focus. I had my recent trip to London for Goth, I got off the plane and they had a car to pick me up, take me into town, which is about, you know, an hour's drive. And we're driving through the streets and it's really gray. It's about 5 in the afternoon, really gray. And it starts to rain, and it's that sort of London rain that goes sideways and stuff, you know. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, this is where it comes from.
In both of the books, you talked about how you and Robert's home lives were so very different, and he came up in a happy, well-to-do home with very supportive parents who let the band practice early on. Yeah. And your house was completely different. It was more disjointed. It was glum. Your dad was emotionally vacant.
Yeah.
And you said that a lot of Robert's writing you thought was a combination of everyone in the band's, the early band's experiences.
I think at that point in time, because we weren't cosmopolitan, we hadn't been around the world, we hadn't seen different places, you know, things become very focused. I always think it's like looking through the other end of the telescope, you know, instead of looking at like what everything is out there, you become micro focused on what's in front of you, which is good and bad, obviously, you know. If that's your whole life, that becomes kind of sad, you know, because you don't have any experience outside of it, you know. But I think, you know, initially we wanted to consider all kinds of things, but when you're younger, you don't really know what that is until things happen to you like that, you know. Yes. So that's like faith. Until something like that had happened to us, it's such an abstract concept, you know, like, oh, well, what's it going to be like if this person is never there again, you know, they're gone.
So during Faith, you had actually experienced death, when before it was more of a romantic idea.
Yeah. And it's completely different. And I mean, you know, as you get older, obviously more of that stuff happens to you. And so it becomes, I think that's why also a lot of people I've met recently who are probably my age and that, and still would label themselves, you know, goth or whatever, they would say to me that for them it was a comfort to know that they understand, you know, more about those things. Because a lot of people's first reaction to having somebody, you know, that they know close to them who's has somebody that's passed away is in a sort of embarrassment. They don't want to talk about it, you know? Like, if they don't know them that well, they're like, oh, well, I'll just mention this once and then let's carry on, you know, with life, which I suppose is kind of natural, you know, because, hey, you know, I die tomorrow, the world goes on, you know, and it's always going to go on, but you kind of don't know what to say. And I think we were just looking for ways to say things a lot of the time, and now
it becomes
much more relevant and poignant, I think.
You also said that a lot of your songs, people, it's sort of a misinterpretation that The Cure's music can be destructive or depressing.
Yeah.
But that's a false notion. And a lot of times, you know, people find solace in the songs and they find them comforting. And you wrote, we're not the problem, we're the cure.
Right. And I thought, you know, that's the obvious thing to say. But, you know, which, you know, is a little hokey, but it's kind of fun to say. Yeah, that would always upset me. Well, not upset me, but I was irritated by the fact people would go, oh, you know, if your music's dark and depressing, then it's going to make people dark and depressed, and then they go, maybe, you know, maybe something bad will happen. You should write something that's uplifting and happy and jolly. And that. And I'm like, no, that's, you've missed the point entirely. People that listen to us, a lot of them would come to say to me, you know, hey, this happened, it was bad, and I had a friend with your music. You know, I had somebody, yeah, I felt there was understanding, so it made it less. It was like, you know, problem shared is a problem halved. So that was really the basis for it. And to me, especially, I can't speak for anybody else, but for me especially, that was my greatest reward in lots of ways, that it would help somebody, you know, yeah, because I know how I felt during those things. And it was good to be able to put that in the music so that people could associate it and use it. Somebody told me recently, you know, the job of a musician is discovery, but it's also, I think I could go further than that. It's not just discovery, it's to bring back whatever you find for people. Because I don't know about you, but that's why I listen to music and like certain things. That's why I read certain things, because I get a confirmation of my own feelings. Yeah, language really is an imperfect construct. You know, like we're talking now, and I hope that what I construct in front of you gives you the ideas of what I'm thinking about, and vice versa. But
right,
we're never quite sure, you know. And sometimes it amazes me that people, well, like I was saying with the Cure's lyrics, you know, people get completely the opposite feeling. You know, sometimes I will, yeah, go into, you know, they have those sites, those websites online, you know, like Genius Lyrics or something. And I read people's interpretations of our lyrics, and some are good, some are off, and some are kind of frightening. But, but you know, everybody has to be somewhere, you know.
We have to take another quick break, and then we'll be back with more from Leah Rose's interview with Lowell Tolhurst. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground,
where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the boar's nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboar'snest.
We're back with the rest of Leah's conversation with Lowell Tolhurst.
With Pornography, which is the fourth album.
Yeah.
So on this one, you said the band really started to fully embrace bleaker themes in the songs.
Yeah.
What was going on in the band, interpersonally, when that album was recorded?
You know, my good friend Julianne Reagan from All About Eve said it very well. You know, we were talking about it, and she said, you know, it's really unnatural, the idea of a band, you know, because you spend, like, you put young people together for a lot of time, like 24/7 for months on end, you know, traveling around all the time, working together, and then spending all their off time together because you're halfway across the world and you've got no other choice. And, you know, you mix alcohol and any other things in with that, and it's a recipe for disaster, you know. And yeah, The Cure are no different. You know, we had spent a lot of time together by the time we got to Pornography. You know, the usual suspects were there floating around. And to me, I said this to Budgie the other week, that the thing that's amazing to me is that as people making that record, I don't think we were very sane. I think there was a lot of insanity, you know. If I look back at the events, and it's interesting, you know, we recorded mostly at night then by that time. You know, we'd been on this sort of nocturnal clock. You know, that suits Robert. Robert's always been a nocturnal kind of person. You know, we would finish a lot of sessions at Rack Studios, which had several studios and different people recording in there. And we would finish sessions at, you know, the early hours of the morning or a bit later. And some days, you know, we'd be leaving the studio as the day staff and people were coming in, you know.
That's a weird feeling.
Oh, yes. It was very weird. You know, like we weren't staying far away, so we didn't have to get too much in the sunlight and watch everybody moving around with, you know, freshly scrubbed.
It really makes you feel like an outsider when you're not part of that early morning hustle and bustle. People are going to work.
Yeah, we just wanted to get home and go to bed. And, you know, I remember meeting Kim Wilde. You know, she was recording in the other studio, and she came in one morning, you know, and I stopped her to talk to her. She must have thought, you know, this is like, how can I get away from this mad person, you know, as quickly as possible? And actually, if I meet her again ever, I'm going to tell her that. I'm going to say, I'm sorry. You know, it was it must have been very scary, you know, to me, because I'm sure I was talking nonsense and, you know, completely insane. But what surprises me for us is, like, as far as we were like that, the music became ultra precise and played like with an intensity and a precision that we had never got before, you know. And that surprises me, because, like, also I tell people, you know, if you're in a three-piece band, you've got nowhere to hide, you know, because if one of you makes a mistake, everybody notices. So you've got to be very sharp. And that was probably the sharpest as musicians we ever were. We were very, very good at it. But, you know, the rest of the stuff that went along with it was too intense. And so then when we went on the tour, something was going to break, you know. And it did in Strasbourg. You know, there was this, we went out to some club, and Robert and Simon had this big fight, and they both got on a plane that night and went home. I woke up and there's just me and the opening band in the hotel. And I knew in my heart of hearts at that point that was going to stop for a while there. I thought it was probably going to be the end of everything. And Robert came back and Simon came back and we finished the tour, finished our obligations and went home. And I thought, well, that's that, you know. And it wasn't, but it was a time for a very big change, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Simon left and it became just me and Robert for a while. And
right.
We made rather different music very quickly.
Yeah, very different music. Yeah, that's right. There was another period I was watching a Cure documentary, and I believe it was your first major tour when you were opening up for Susie and the Banshees, and then Robert eventually joined the band as a guitarist. And was that another point where it seemed like maybe the band would break up?
You know, I always knew, as I think I said in Cure, I always knew in my heart of hearts that Robert wasn't going to stay with the Banshees forever, because just being, you know, the side guy, the guitarist, was never going to be enough for him. You know, he had his own ideas, his own stuff he wanted to do. But I also think that at that point, you know, him and Michael weren't getting on so well. So it was a nice, it was a relief for him to go there and spend some time with them, do that in a different way. And I was open to that. I didn't have that thing in my head that said, oh no, you have to stay. I didn't feel that it would hurt things. I thought it would add to stuff. I thought, well, you know, if he'll go there, he'll find out a different way of doing things and he can bring that back to us. So that was what I always thought. Well, he'll bring that back to us, which he did. But I think, you know, in retrospect, there's always that little bit of stuff like, well, you know, this is our band. This is what we're doing. You know, that isn't our band. So, you know, you have to consider that. But, you know, it worked out.
Are there any tracks on Pornography that really stand out to you or have an especially interesting story about how the song was created?
Well, I mean, you know, the first song was the first 100 years was the first time that we did actually use, you know, a drum machine, because that's a drum machine on there. And I played keyboards, and that was the first time I played keyboards on a Cure record. So that was something different to start off with, you know, and we had this tiny little Boss drum machine, and we had to figure out how to sort of separate things, because you can't really separate the sounds from it. So we put things through different amps and made it so that, you know. But for live, we used to take a reel-to-reel tape recorder with the drum machine on for some reason, but it worked. So I like that. And then Cold is probably my favorite start to any Cure song, because, you know, I had set the kit up in this huge room, so that gives it its big sound. And I had bought this big Chinese cymbals from a store in London, Ray Mann's, which is like all sort of, you know, exotic instruments. And you have to remember the cymbals, when they were first made, like, you know, 400 years ago, and were instruments of war. They were what they used to march across the top of the hills and frighten the hell out of their enemies, right? So, but some of the original ones are so loud. You know, I'm sure it's part of my hearing loss, you know, because every time I would hit this thing, I'd have to turn my head sideways. So I love the beginning of Cold for that reason. And also at the end, the title track, Pornography, we did some interesting manipulations. I mean, it was a fun album to do in that respect. I say fun, you know, the sessions were a little strange, but it was fun. Also, you know, Phil Thornley, who produced it with us, was younger than us. I think he was like 21, which blows my mind. I talk to him occasionally now and I say, you know, do you realize how young we were when you did that record? You know, I don't know how, you know, how that happened. You know, it was very, very strange. So, you know, it's like a lot of things in the Cure's existence are happy accidents, you know.
At what point during your time with the Cure did you start to see the audiences grow?
Well, they were sort of increasing as we got up to Pornography. But with Pornography, we went out on tour, and that was probably another thing that contributed to it, because we got put into a lot bigger rooms to play. But the album wasn't out yet, and most of our set that we played for that tour was the new album. So people didn't know it, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was the first time that, since we'd started, that audiences hadn't got exponentially bigger every year we played, you know. And when you do it the first time, You don't even understand how that works or doesn't work. You just accept it. It's not being nonchalant or egotistical. I just sort of accepted, oh, well, you know, this is what happens now. There's bigger audience. Yeah. And then with pornography, it started to be half full. And it was, I think, oh, that's weird. Why is that happening? You know, and so it added something. But then after that period where we'd finished the sort of singles, you know, with Love Cats and The Walk and everything, it started to pick up again and started to get bigger again from there. And it's just sort of continued pretty much ever since, with a little dip in the middle, I think, for Britpop, which was like, you know, the end of everything for a lot of people. But then, you know,
yeah,
it came around again, so we're fine.
Do you ever think, like, if you had a different upbringing, that you would have ended up in a different band, like being Duran Duran or something?
You know, that's impossible. That's how do we know? You know, I have no looking glass, or, you know, yeah. I can't tell you. I mean, yeah, I mean, I nearly ended up in Adam and the Ants, but, you know, because I met Adam one night in London, and he was just starting the new version of the band, you know, with the two drummers and that, with Terry Lee and everything. So I'm like, he said, you know, so I'm starting this new band. Do you, you know, new version of the Ants, do you want to, you know, come along and try out? And that, and I'm like, yeah, it's okay. I got this band, The Cure, so I'm going to carry on, you know, which I'm glad I did. But, you know, yeah. So I could have ended up with the, you know, the makeup and the funny hair. And,
right. Yeah, speaking of makeup and the funny hair, I heard that Robert's image changed drastically. He started teasing his hair, putting on lipstick after he joined the Banshees and saw Susie Sue. Is that accurate?
You know, it's easy to connect the dots when you look from afar, but I don't remember it happening like that, because there were a lot of people, you know, like we would go out. We'd always go out on a Thursday night to the Camden Palace in London, and, you know, people always say the Batcave, but I remember the Palace as being pretty much sort of the center of the universe at that time, and there was lots of different people there
with that look.
Yeah, with that look, you know, obviously we all adapt everything you see around you, you know, because this was our people. So this is like, okay, right, we want to show we're part of this, and so it went from there. Obviously Sue was a very pivotal person in that scene. I think six of one and half a dozen of the other, you know. I never really know exactly where it came from, you know.
So it wasn't like one day it was, you know, one way, and then the next day it's like a whole new.
Well, no, he went through several permutations, including, I say the word permutation, he had a perm at one point, a sort of funny perm that was jagged, you know. It looks okay, but then, you know, we changed, we did something else. You know?
I'm so glad perms are gone.
Yeah, me too.
How did it feel when you eventually left the band? How did it feel seeing this band go on without you, a band that you created when you were so young and you were in for so long and had so many formative experiences in? How did it feel to see it go on without you?
Well, you know, I can't lie. It was painful in lots of ways in the beginning. Over the years, I've realized, look, there's two things, you know. The day I die, my obituary, I know what it's going to say, you know, if I get one. It'll say, you know, like, yeah, co-founder of The Cure. That's what it's going to say. That's going to be the headline. I can't escape that. So rather than trying to escape it, I'll acknowledge it and embrace it. So I'm very pleased with what we did. I'm very happy about what we did. And I'm very proud of what we did. You know, I still have a relationship with most of the people in the band, and they're people I've known most of my life, you know. Yeah. So you can't not have a relationship, you know. It's like family, you know. At some point, yeah, you got to circle back. In fact, that's the easiest way to describe it, family. I mean, a few weeks ago, The Cure were here in Los Angeles, and I went to see everybody. And there was a couple of funny things. I took my niece, who's just in her last year at university, and, you know, so she's like 21, and she'd never seen them play live before. Well, she has, but she doesn't remember, and because she was a little girl. And so I took her there, and we were sort of all hanging out afterwards down in the dressing room at the Hollywood Bowl. And it was, for me, it was like being back in the pub in 1977, you know, because it was kind of strange, because, like, you know, I'm sitting talking to Simon, we're talking about things, talking to Robert. Robert's wife was there. You know, she's very rarely on the road. So, you know, I know her very well. So we're talking. And for me, it was good as well, because like a lot of band members, you know, have children. And some of them I know and seen, and some of them I've never met, you know, so I got a chance to meet them and stuff. And it was very emotional, but it was also very healing in a good way, you know, because I get to realize, okay, this is my family, and it's never going to change, really. You know, things go up and down like most families, but it's always going to be there, you know. And it was a very bonding time. And I think a lot of that's to do with the fact that we're all getting older, and, you know, there's not so many of us around anymore, even. So it's like, you know, people in the band have passed away, Andy passed away and stuff. So it's like, okay, we still have a lot in common. In fact, Robert said that to me. He said, you know, we have a lot to talk about. Backstage at the Hollywood Bowl is probably not the place to, but we do. We have a lot to talk about. And so, you know, I'm sure, you know, things will carry on in some fashion or another, and that's fine by me. And I'm very happy with what I'm doing myself now. So
yeah, I was going to say, it's a testament to you and to your personality, your outlook, that you're not just stewing in bitterness. You're moving forward. You've written these incredible books. You're making music. You have this wonderful relationship, working relationship with Budgie.
Yeah. So, you know, and that really is the only way that you're going to live through this life. You know, I mean, that's one of the reasons I got on a plane and came to California, because at the point where I came to California, my life had fallen apart. You know, my band had gone, my first marriage was dissolving. You know, I owed a lot of money to the court for a court, disastrous court case. So, you know, I arrived here. You know, I wasn't really a stranger in a strange land. I kind of was, and I kind of wanted to be that. But I knew California a bit from, you know, working here a lot. And I liked the place. And what was really good for me, and I tell people this all the time, was, you know, a lot of people think of California, you know, and this is true in England, people think this as well, you know, like you come here to be discovered or destroyed or both, you know, both things can happen, you know, and sometimes they do. And that wasn't my experience. My experience was I found love, I found acceptance, and I found my tribe. You know, I found people that I've been able to connect with and work with and do things over the years. And it's been much more a healing experience than I was ever expecting, you know. And so, therefore, it's become home, and I feel a great affection for the place. And it's been great. And if I think about it, it's been like over 30 years now. So, you know, it's like I've lived two lives, two complete lives, you know. And you know, it's beyond my sort of wildest expectations.
It's incredible. Well, thank you so much, Lowell, for talking today. I really appreciate it. I loved your books. I highly recommend them to everybody listening.
Thank you.
And best of luck with the new album.
Thank you so much, and we'll talk again.
Thanks to Lowell Tolhurst for sharing his experience with The Cure. He's written two excellent books that are out now, and you can hear our favorite songs from his days with The Cure and his solo work on our playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose and Eric Sandler. Our show is engineered by Echo Mountain. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like this show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight?
a room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.